Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me is returning host and captain of the incomparable, Jason Snell.
John, is it me or is it my Martian duplicate? I don't know.
Here we are in the future. It's 2020. It's,
yeah.
Did you ever think you would live this long?
They're going to have to. I didn't. And they're going to have to change the dates on the Martian Chronicles again and push it further forward.
Okay, well, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Sorry. But
we are, in fact, doing this time. We were returning to Ray Bradbury. I'm forgetting his name. Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles. We're returning to Ray Bradbury, which we did Fahrenheit 451. I think it was like the third or fourth book I did. And it's taking me this long to get back around to The Martian Chronicles, which is the other book of his that gets taught in high schools.
For sure. For sure. And it's not a book, right? I mean, or it's a book, but it's not a novel. It's a term I had not actually heard before, a fix-up, according to Wikipedia. But, you know, essentially it's a short story collection. And the fix-up part is that it's been kind of like selected and sequenced and maybe even some new material stuck in there. But the idea is it sort of makes it seem like it's all connected, but it's really just a bunch of potentially interlinked short stories. So a fix up, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, in this case, it's a little obvious to anyone who's read anything that the individual stories here were not necessarily written with continuity in mind.
Right.
Partly because the Martians keep changing what they are.
That's true.
There is a sort of an explanation given to it, like where in one of the stories they mention, oh, there's two kinds of Martians, there's these Martians and those Martians. But to be honest, from story to story, what it means to be a Martian is very different. And that doesn't really matter because as the story goes on, the Martians themselves fade off into the distance, sadly, and we're left with humanity having to deal with human problems on this new world.
It's funny reading it as an adult, and this is the whole story of this podcast, right? My perspective on it is different. As a kid, I think I was like, wow, it's science fiction. I get to read it, you know, and it's respectable because it's Ray Bradbury and we can talk about it in class or whatever. And as an adult, I look at it and first I think, yeah, it's just a bunch of short stories that he kind of stuck together, some of which are not set on Mars and don't really have anything to do with it. But it's like, all right, I'm just going to stick them all in here. And it sort of has a story arc. But what really struck me about it is, you know, you mentioned the Martians and the different kinds and all that. And it's like, oh, I see what this is. This is about, it's about frontiers and settlers and, you know, Native Americans. I mean, it's so much easier as an adult to look at this and think, oh, wow, the settlers move in and kill off whoever was there before. And like, that's, if there's a through line here, it's like, that's what it's all about, is sort of the Europeans coming and destroying the people who were there before and then, you know, kind of like running roughshod over the land. I was surprised just how much of that is in here. I was like, oh, okay, that's what this is. Because as a kid, I didn't think about that at all.
Well, that was what, you know, that was this what this period of science fiction was all about. It was about, you know, allegory.
This was
this book, the original version of this book was published in 1950, but the stories in it were written earlier, going back, I think, into the 1940s, maybe some even earlier. So that puts it at, you know, here, you can help me out with this, because I never quite figured this out. This is the end of the golden era of science fiction, which
oh.
I
Yeah, I was really bad with those labels, but
I gather it was marked by the publications of Hugo Gernsback and others in the, although a lot of these stories, looking at the Wikipedia page, were published in fairly high-end magazines like Collier's and stuff.
But there's a lot of thrilling wonder stories in there too, right? Like it's a little bit of both. But allegories in science fiction is one of my favorite things, and I just didn't really think about how Bradbury did it. And my first exposure, I should say, to this is that weird, what, NBC miniseries that they did of the Martian Chronicles, which is narratively a little more focused than this book is, but not a lot. And although there's one story in here, that the one that stuck with me from the TV show is in here, and it's the one where there's like the one guy and he goes out into the woods and he comes back and he starts just killing all of the other people. Or is that third expedition, I guess, is that one?
Yeah.
Kind of commingled in the miniseries, but so that was my first really introduction to it, and that was a very strange 70s sci-fi production on television.
I recommend anyone, I'm sure it must be at least in clips on YouTube.
Yeah, I guess 1980, but yeah, it's a very, it has that feel, that late 70s kind of feel.
Yeah, it starred like Rock Hudson.
Oh yeah, Darren McGavin, Fritz Weaver. Yeah, there's a bunch of interesting people in it.
And like a young Bernadette Peters is in it too. Yeah. I remember like looking forward to this because there had been a new blossoming of interest in science fiction following the success of Star Wars, and a lot of networks were trying to do serious or semi-serious science fiction, and this came out on, and I remember being just utterly confused by it.
Yeah.
And then I tried to read the stories, and I was confused and a little sad, which is, I think, the point that Bradbury was trying to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the having, you know, seeing what the Martian Chronicles miniseries adapted, I look at that having just read it and think, oh yeah, that makes sense, right? Like how do we do this? And they did, it's three episodes, this miniseries, and it really is the first missions, which all kind of end in disaster because they have these encounters with Martians, and there's like, you know, one of them sort of like a Twilight Zone story, and you know, and there's that super creepy third mission where there's the guy who goes out into the desert and comes back and he's dressed as a Martian. Is he a Martian? He kills everybody. And then the second one is about that other creepy story that's in there about the, like, they come back and it's like all these people from Earth are there. And that's very strange. And then the third one is dealing with the latter part of the book, which is sort of like there's been a nuclear war on Earth, and most people have already left Mars because they went back to Earth for the nuclear war, which is also really weird. And but some people are left on Mars, and they I get why they did that, because I mean, who had the cockamamie idea to adapt a bunch of short stories into a miniseries? It must have been like Star Wars was big with the kids, and they're like, Martian Chronicles, we could do that, because it doesn't kind of really make any sense. The through line of the book is there, but it's flimsy. It really is just to draw you into these individual stories.
Right. Well, one last word on the miniseries, and then we will get to the book. I think that the miniseries also was an example of a style of entertainment that was really popular in the mid 70s and started to die off by the early 80s, which was the ensemble piece, people really associate mostly with like the films of Irwin Allen and the big disaster films, where you just had as many stars as you could possibly get into 2 hours, and everybody gets maybe 5 or 10 minutes of screen time, and there's all these stories going on at once.
Perfect for a short story adaptation, right? Because you're never really sticking with characters for very long.
Exactly. Well, in the lead up to recording this, I mentioned to you that I would need to have the Wikipedia page open because the characters don't really stick in this book.
I would
argue that the most poignant and fully realized character in this book is the house that continues on after the nuclear war on Earth.
In Usher 2, yeah. Uh-huh.
Actually, I was thinking of There Will Come Soft
Rain. Oh, There Will Come Soft Rain, yeah. No, that's right. There's two houses. There's the bad house that kills people, and there's the good house that is doing its job, even though everybody on Earth is dead.
Usher 2 has has another memorable house. So.
No, but you're right. You're right. That is one of the really great ones in here, right, is There Will Come Soft Rains, because it is tragic, and it's this, you know, it's a smart home like we have today, and it keeps running after everyone dies, and it's doing its best to, like, keep the house ready to go for everybody, but gradually over the course of the story you realize that they're all dead, and but you're right, there are some interesting people. Like, there's the guy, but again, I'm not even bringing up their names, because, like, there is the guy in Usher 2 who is trying to kill people who are censors, and there is the guy who's out in the middle of nowhere in his truck or whatever and meets the Martian, and they're, like, looking, they can see each other, but they're in different time frames, and, you know, there are people who populate this story, but, like, there's none of them really have a through line except for a couple of the characters from one of the expeditions, and they're kind of not the point. Like, they're all like in the Earthmen one, which is a very Twilight Zone kind of thing. Like, it's, you know, it's kind of a horror movie, and those guys are there, and they're present, and a terrible thing happens to them, and that's, you know, but yeah, are they memorable characters? Not only in the fact that things are inflicted on them in interesting ways, I guess.
Right. Well, one of the interesting things about this book is it exists in several forms. There was the 1950 book, and then later Bradbury decided he wanted to take out some stories and put in other stories for different editions. So depending on which copy of the book you have, you may or may not have, there's a story called The Fire Balloons, which is about Episcopal priests coming to Mars to evangelize to the Martians. And that may or may not be in the copy of the book you have. If you buy a new copy of the book, it will be in there.
Right.
There's also a terrible, absolutely forgettable, except for its incredibly retrograde views on gender, story about two women leaving for Mars. One of them wants to go where her sweetheart is. Yep. The other one wants to find a husband. And as you mentioned, one of the strange things that Bradbury did was somewhere where in one of these editions, one of these later editions, it was, I think, in 1997, changed all the dates of the expeditions of the book. They moved them all ahead by 31 years. And from the point of view of the artist, they want to think that their work is timeless. They want to think that their work is not a product of a particular moment. But this is very much a book full of stories that are products of a particular moment.
Yeah.
And I don't know why he's trying to pretend otherwise. If he had just left those dates as they were, it would have been fine. And everyone would have understood, oh, this is the idea of the future in 1950. And in fact, people would be charmed by that. But instead, now they all have the dates all changed, and some of the things don't make any sense anymore, because people have attitudes, gender attitudes, racial attitudes, certainly attitudes about politics and the such, that they did not have in the 1990s. They had them in the 1950s.
Yeah, it's a game. You can keep moving it, right? Because they're not accurate for the year 2000 either. So you can keep moving it. I feel like it's Bradbury just sort of like fighting against his own mortality and saying, no. I always want this to seem like it's going to happen in the future. But the problem is that, yes, it's a document from 1950. And therefore, you know, just sawing, you know, or like sanding off the dates and painting in like, it's 2030 instead of 1999, reading it today doesn't really change it. I mean, it amused me in the sense it's like, aha, rocket ships in the future, that like it was funny, but like it's just not the point. This is in that classic weird zone of science fiction where it's visions of the future that are now the past. And I think, you just have to deal with that. Like when there's a Star Trek episode where they talk about World War III in 1980, the far future of 1984 or something like that, like, ooh, the future. It's like, you just have to deal with the fact that this is old predicting a future depicting a future that didn't happen. I'll throw in that his concept of Mars is very much influenced by Edgar Rice Burroughs, right? This is and popular culture in general, but Burroughs in particular, like, it's an inhabited Mars and a habitable Mars. And from a Bradbury was never a hard sci-fi guy anyway. It's all kind of fantasy, but like this is a very different kind of Mars anyway. It doesn't really have any connection to the real Mars. And so because it's an allegory for traveling to a new world, is like literally it's traveling to the new world. This is all about, you know, the frontier and colonization and killing the natives and taking their land. That I at some point it's like, why are you even trying to pretend that this is real and timely and all of those things? Because it's not. It's an old way of viewing Mars. Even in 1950, it was an old way of viewing Mars, and certainly by the time you got to 1997, it was.
Right. Well, the thing it borrows most from Edgar Rice Burroughs' John Carter books is the idea of Mars as a dying planet.
Right.
If you go back and reread those Burroughs novels, they're about an Earthman who comes to Mars and he finds a world that's past its prime. There's most of the great cities of Mars now lie in ruins. Resources are dwindling because the atmosphere is literally getting thinner, and there's no indication of how much longer it can continue. And so it's broken apart into these warring clans that inhabit the ruins of antiquity.
Right.
I think that comes out of this Victorian idea when they first looked at Mars, and that, when I forget his name, the Italian guy thought he saw canals on Mars.
Right.
And there's a way to, you have to kind of make sense of that. And there, it seems like there's something there, but there's no indication of life anymore. Maybe there was at some time. And it's not too far, actually, from War of the Worlds, in that the War of the Worlds Martians are driven by the fact that their planet is failing them as well.
I love the idea of an ancient culture that's now in disrepair, and now the new culture arrives and they find their mysteries to be discovered. Although, as you said, the depiction of the Martians really varies. And at times it's sort of like the idea is that there was more there than there is now, but who's there and why they're there and all of that is kind of like, in some of the stories, it's sort of like, well, there are Martians around, but there aren't that many of them. And others are like, the Martians died out long ago. And it's like, okay, which is it? And the answer is, it doesn't matter, because there's no through line. And it's just, it just is the idea, again, that you're getting your boots dusty in this weird, mostly uninhabited world that used to belong to someone else. And you're making your life here. And that's like, so one again and again, whether it's like coming over on ships from, you know, from Europe to North America, or whether it's on horses and buggies and stuff like that to get across North America, or whatever it is, it's that kind of story. And on one level, I think there are moments in some of the stories where I feel very much like it's saying, we're kicking out these people and taking over, and like there's some judgment there. And other times, not. Other times it's like, it's just like it was when the settlers settled America. There was nothing there, and they made a life for themselves. It's like, well, there was something there.
Bradbury also cites Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio as a big influence on this. And having done that again for the podcast, I see it, but in the sense that Winesburg, Ohio is another novel that's made up of a bunch of short stories that may or may not connect. They all take place in the same Midwestern town, but there's only a handful of characters that get mentioned in more than one stories, and there's only, I think, like two or three stories where the action of one story informs the action of another. Whitesboro, Ohio is a story about people who are desperately unhappy in a small town in the Midwest, and they're unhappy because they feel like outcasts. And I feel like this book is trying for a bit of the melancholy of Winesburg, Ohio. And I feel of two minds about that. I feel like sometimes Bradbury hits the nail on the head. I think we've mentioned There Will Come Soft Rains. The story that you mentioned where the one man meets the Martian.
Oh yeah, Night Meeting is
Night
what
meeting.
That's called.
Right. That one is strange and wonderful.
I think that's my favorite one, and it is super melancholy, right? Because it's almost, it even leaves you with the judgment, like, who is who? Like, is he meeting a future Martian who is looking at the ruins of our society, or is he in the present and the Martians in the past? And there's like this, it's very good, because it is sort of like everything passes, everything ends. It's all your matter of perspective. You're living in the moment now, and you should, because it won't last. Like it's really good, but you know, they are individual short stories. So I think one of the challenges is he's never always saying it the same way, right? Like every story has its own take on it, and it's not consistent because it really isn't a unified story.
Well, it's interesting that looking at Wikipedia here, it says that Night Meeting was the only story that was written for the book.
There are interstitial bits, but that's the one full-blown short story that's just for Martian Chronicles.
Right. And so that you can look to that as a way, as Bradbury imposing the theme onto this book.
Sure.
And if there is a theme, there is this theme of transience, of the way in which perspective is completely subjective, whether you are who's the Martian, who's the person who belongs here, who's the person who's the outsider, those things are all there. But a lot of these stories, you know, some of these stories fall into the category of, you know, when I was a kid, I would try sometimes to read like Isaac Asimov's science fiction magazine, and I never really got into it because I never found the stories to be that interesting. But
yep,
there was this, every episode of Isaac Asimov's science fiction magazine that was published when I was a kid had one stupid gag story that was like two pages long, and it ended with a bad pun.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only point of it, was to have a story that set up a pun at the end of it. And I guess that was a thing that was viable.
Yeah.
And there are bits in this that feel like jokes, that like there's like a setup and a punchline. Uh-huh. Like there's the one late in the story where there are almost no humans left on Mars after the desolation of Earth, and things are going bad for the humans settling on Mars, and whole cities are uninhabited, and there's like this one guy left, and he's unsure whether he's the only guy on Mars, and he gets a phone call, or he's able to make phone contact with the what seems like the only woman on Mars, and the joke is they come together and he finds her hideous.
Yeah.
And that's supposed to be the joke.
Yeah. I'm surprised that, because that's called The Silent Towns, but it should be called something like Not If You Were the Last Woman on Mars or something like that, right? Because that's what it is. It's just a joke. Yeah.
The tone of these stories varies wildly. In the earlier stories where there actually are Martians and what they are changes a bit, we have set up that these Martians are telepathic, and that their telepathy is kind of strange because they take on consciousness around them. They take on Earth consciousness. They can feel it coming to them, like the very first story, in which there is a domestic story about two Martians who are unhappily married, and the wife is having dreams about the Earthmen coming to Mars.
Right. So the husband goes out and kills them. I mean, that's,
right. It's another kind of dumb joke. But later in the stories, this idea of the Martians taking on telepathically the wishes and the desires and the lost loves. There's a story in which a Martian keeps changing between being a loved person that each person in this town has lost, and it basically kills him because he's unable to maintain stability. He's just taking on all these emotions, and he becomes this psychic sponge for all this sadness. That's a really sad story.
Yeah.
And you compare that to the first one.
Yeah, I feel like that when this is at its best, it is about, you know, you said melancholy earlier. I'd say at its best, it's about all things being ephemeral, but it's also about this sort of one of the things that drives the human spirit is sort of like there are always people. And early on, you see it where it's like portraying people leaving to go to the rocket. Like, and people are leaving to go to Mars to settle. It's like the wagons are rolling out. And there's this thought of like, we are driven to do that, but that is a fundamentally distancing and lonely experience, right? Because you're going away from everything you've ever known and you may not go back there again. And I think when those senses of loss, like you're loss that sometimes is on purpose, but it's also inevitable in general, that's when these stories are their most powerful. That whether the loss is, you know, you're by choice, you're choosing to leave everything you know to go to a new place, or whether it's just the inevitability that time will move on and you will, you know, you will be lost and you'll lose the things that you love. I think that's all really good. But then the fact that this is a fix up, like, and then there's Usher too, which is a fun story that is very clearly the mind who brought you Fahrenheit 451, right? It's a very similar kind of story, perhaps even suggesting the same universe, but like that's a totally different thing tonally about a dude who's mad about censorship and he rigs up a whole Edgar Allan Poe murder house. And like, again, good story, but not part of the stuff that I really liked thematically, which is just this. Yeah, it's just sort of sad. Like, people are sad because they're alone. People are sad because their loved ones are back on Earth. People are sad because Earth's going to blow up. People are sad. The Martians are sad because their civilization has ended. That's, you know, that the sad parts of this felt like the most resonant for me, I think.
Right. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about Usher 2 more, because that is a very strange story.
Yeah. And
it's the one that sticks out as obviously not written to be on Mars anyway. It's like he put it on Mars because why not, I guess.
Uh-huh.
He just had this story hanging around. But it's, as you say, it's about a character. His name is Stendhal, who is angered by the fact that there is this governmental edict that works of fantasy and horror must be repressed. And this is you're right, this is very like Fahrenheit 451. Mm-hmm. People like to make the claim that Fahrenheit 451 is a book that's like an anti-book burning book because it features book burning, and they make sort of the very strong liberal claim that Bradbury was upset about people trying to repress ideas. But really, what Bradbury was on about in 451 was being anti-PC. He said that the problem was, in this future world, people were too concerned about hurting each other's feelings, and that's why books got banned. Was that every minority would complain that X book didn't reflect their situation, and so entertainment becomes blander and blander. And in this case, it seems like Bradbury, in the case of Usher 2, Bradbury is really taking to task the idea of pop psychologists. This is a little bit before Frederick Wortham and Seduction of the Innocent, but it's like that idea that young minds are going to get warped if they read too much fantasy, and particularly too much horror. But in a way, the story makes the case that maybe it's not a good idea to read a lot of horror, because he becomes a big murderer guy.
Crazed killer who, and you know, very much a Cask of Amontillado stuff going on here. And, you know, it's because it is like an Edgar Allan Poe story. And it's also an homage. The building itself is an homage to Edgar Allan Poe. But you're right. We did an incomparable episode about 1984 and Fahrenheit 451. I remember us talking about that, like then, that I'm a little uncomfortable by some of Bradbury's kind of like takes on on censorship, because it instead of it being about people should be able to be exposed to ideas, it becomes authors should be able to do whatever the hell they want, which is, I get it if you're an author that you want to think that, but it's sort of like, is that the point of freedom of expression? I mean, is it? I view it from the consumer standpoint, which is that the government and the society should let me see a lot of ideas and decide for myself. I just always found that he made it very strangely about, like you said, political correctness kind of things of like, I should be able to upset people. And they should just deal with it. And it's like, well, you know, yeah, but you're kind of a jerk if that's what your goal is. And this is Usher too. It's like, on one hand, I'm like, yeah, this censorship is really bad. Also, you built a murder house.
The other thing that's funny about this murder house is that a lot of the plot hinges on the fact that he's able to create robotic simulations of people.
Like duplicates. Pure duplicates.
So well duplicated that people who know that person would be fooled by that.
Right.
And it works okay if you take the story out and this is just some silly fantasy, you know, where it's a crazy Looney Tunes world where you don't have to worry about the fact that there's no way robotics would ever work that way. And that also in some ways mitigates the fact that he's killing everyone, because then it just becomes this crazy little cartoon. But when you put this into the middle of this other set of stories, then you start worrying about how does this technology fit in with the rest of the technology in the book, and how does the ethics of what's happening here fit in with the ethics of the rest of this book. That's what happens when tone shifts so quickly from thing to thing.
We keep on coming back to the central issue, which is it's a fix-up. It's a series of stories. There are some really good stories in here. If I were, like, from, again, you know, it's been so long now, but it, through a modern lens, 70 years later, what I would say is, as somebody who has worked as an editor, I look at this and think... Who am I to give advice? This is a legendary work, right? But I look at it and I think some of these stories are good, but they don't fit thematically. You should kick them out and either make this shorter, or you should write some more new material, and this should be more tightly linked. And I think if you look at the history of a publishing of stuff like this, there are other examples of linked stories that are that kind of are almost like novels. That are more cohesive, and this one just isn't. And you know, it's fine, we're still talking about it 70 years later, but at the same time, that's one of the things that's kind of perplexing about it, is I wish it was a little more consistent. It's not even the through line. I don't need the characters to continue. It's a short story anthology, but I'd love some consistency in the themes and like some of the definitions of who the Martians are. And this is, I'm not going to get it. I just sort of have to pick and choose, because the individual moments can be great. And then there's other stuff that's just boring. And the beauty of it is, if you don't like it, just wait a minute and there'll be another story right after it. And you can just blow past that, because some of the stories are really are chilling, and some of them are funny, and some of them are very Twilight Zone, O. Henry kind of things. The one where they think they're all hallucinations. The Martians think the humans, we haven't mentioned that yet, they think the humans are hallucinations. And the more that the humans admit to, or like try to convince them that they're real, it just convinces all the Martians that they're crazy, and then they kill themselves. And so they're trapped. It's fun. It's terrible and creepy and fun, but you know, then you turn to a melancholy story, like the guys standing out by the, you know, side of the road looking at their respective time frames, and wow, that's some whiplash there.
Right. Well, you mentioned that the characters don't need to persist from story to story. I just wish there were more actual characters in this book. One of the problems with this kind of allegorical approach to science fiction is that characters spout opinions, you know, that's their character. This character is here to represent rugged individualism. This character is here to represent I don't know, the ravages of age. And I mentioned before this story, The Fire Balloons, which is about the two priests trying to preach the good news. And one of the priests becomes obsessed with the idea of converting Martians. The other priest says, no, you were here to help the people here. We don't even know if Martians have souls. And the reason this story kind of bugs me is I like the stuff when they actually meet the Martians, mm-hmm. and the Martians are weird and ineffable. And this is, like, again, another breed of Martians, yep. that have somehow transcended their material forms and become pure energy.
Uh-huh.
Much like Mike and the Bots did at the end of the sci-fi episodes of Mystery Science Theater.
I was going to say every advanced alien race in Star Trek also is it being a pure energy. That's just sort of where it's all headed.
The priests are dull, and I don't believe Bradbury really took the time to even look at a book of theology. It's like the priests are making the most boring theological points that aren't what I think an actual Episcopal priest would be interested, mm-hmm. in. You know, I assure you that people have spent a long time over the course of thousands of years thinking about the issues or whether or not non-human life can be thought of as having a soul, being in need of salvation. The priest here is just talking like this is something that's just occurred to him.
I think I'm coming around to your point earlier that maybe the most interesting character in the whole book is that house.
Well, the house is interesting also because, as you mentioned before, it's a smart home. Bradbury is not a science fiction author you read for interesting predictions about future technology. As we've mentioned before, in Usher 2, he posits robots that make no sense. They like, but I'm always fascinated by the way people thought technology was going to go.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason this fascinates me is this character is just like whipping up robots all the time to look like and act like people. And I'm thinking like, wait, what? How are they? What are the criteria they're using to create artificial intelligence? It reminded me of, oh, I wish I could remember it. There was an episode in the original Star Trek where Kirk asks the computer, you know how he always would say, like, computer, mm-hmm. and the voice would come on and he'd say, like, calculate the odds that a intelligent race of beings would emerge on this planet that would have X trait or whatever. And I thought to myself, oh my God, what kind of crazy algorithm is going to do that? You know, what data do they have?
It's kind of the magical computer, what can't they do kind of thing. And then in there what will come soft rains, like, it's not quite right, but it's a much more interesting, realistic, like, what are the modern conveniences, right? And in 1950, when he's writing for Collier's, it's very much like, let's take modern conveniences to the extreme. Plus, we've got a little bit of nuclear threat here because it's a, but it is really about like, what are the modern conveniences? And it's a little Jetsons of like, you're going to have a robot that does this thing and all that. But it's not unreasonable in the idea of like, technology is going to try to free you from drudgery. Now, again, what this has to do with the Martian Chronicles is essentially nothing other than because it's told about the aftermath of a nuclear war, timeline-wise, it works with the Martian Chronicles. But, you know, and he didn't even change it to set it on Mars after everybody leaves. He sets it on Earth so that the family can have been killed by the nuclear blast. But it's a fun thing because it really is just in detail. Like, here are all the automated things this family has, except the sadness of the fact that the house is waiting for a family who's never going to come home because they got vaporized.
Yes, I was very sad that the house set up the room for a game of bridge because I love bridge, and it made me very sad to think of no one playing bridge. And they had cocktails, too.
Yeah, yeah.
The book ends with the story, The Millionaire Picnic, which is another lovely story that gets anthologized a lot. And it's also the name of one of the oldest comic book shops in North America, the Millionaire Picnic, which is over in Harvard Square. And I want to put a plug in. They aren't sponsoring me, but if you ever get out to Boston, do make a trip to Harvard Square and do go see the Millionaire Picnic. It's a special little store.
I've been to Harvard Square, but I don't think I've ever been in Millionaire Picnic, so I'm going to have to do that the next time I'm out there. That's great.
Anyway, this is the story of this family that is the father says, "Oh, we're going to show you Martians. We're going to go on a picnic." They take him up the river. They go through all the ruined homes, the ruined cities of Mars, and at the end, he says, "Okay, kids, you're the Martians now."
Yeah.
And he blows up their spaceship.
Yeah.
I always thought, you know, when I was a kid, I remember that they did in the TV series with this. I always thought that the implication was these are the last people now. And I thought, and my mind went to like, what do they do when the kids want to have kids? But reading the story through this time, I find that in the actual story, they mentioned that there are other people coming into these other survivalists are coming out here, and they might have marriageable children. Although right. The gene pool is going to be very small,
very very small. Well, it's all very vague too, because it's like, did everybody really leave Mars, or did just a lot of people leave Mars and go back to Earth to be blown up at the nuclear war? And how many different rockets can be salvaged on Earth and flown to Mars to escape the nuclear holocaust? Probably more than a handful. But it's going to be a very different thing. They're like, they're really out on the frontier, back on the frontier again, this time after Earth civilization has also collapsed. So it's the mirroring. It's a nice little bit thematically, right? Like, first, it's the people from Earth and the Martian civilization has collapsed. And now in this, they are the Martians. But they really are, because like Earth's civilization has collapsed and all that's left is the people on Mars. The idea that we're going to burn the ships, essentially another classic kind of New World exploration thing going on here. We're going to burn the ships so we can't go back, and they burn a map of Earth. And it's like, forget it. And this is a moment, this is in that miniseries, and it's a moment that I remember very clearly from that 1980 NBC miniseries, which is that last shot of the miniseries with the kids and the family looking down on the water of the Martian canal and seeing their reflections in the water and saying, there they are, I see the Martians. And that's how that miniseries ends, just like the book ends. And it's great. It's weird, but it's sad, but it's like the end of something, but also maybe the beginning of something new. And again, I feel like if there is a recurring, if not overarching, but recurring theme here, it is that sort of sadness of everything ends, societies end, but people are always like seeking new places, and they create new spaces where they can create something new. That happens again and again in these stories.
There is a very famous series of paperback books from the the 50s called the Del Keyhole books, which were originally mystery novels that had like a little keyhole with an eye poking through them.
Right.
And they were famous because on the back of the book, they had a map that would show like the action of the book. That was like their gimmick. Like, you would look at this. And I know that there was a Del Keyhole map made for the Millionaire Picnic, and I'm trying to Google it now. People out there can look it up. It just shows like the trip that the family took down the river in Mars. It's a very, very charming bit of 1950s culture. I like what you say about the frontier, because I did go to a graduate program in American Studies, and if you study American Studies, you cannot escape, and I've mentioned this before on the podcast, a very famous essay that was published in 1893 called The Significance of the Frontier in American History, which was by Frederick Jackson Turner, and it put forward what's called the Turner thesis. And people may have heard of this, which is that the presence of a frontier throughout most of American history up till the end of the 19th century shaped the American character, and that the idea was that Americans are used to thinking that that resources are unlimited, that the most important thing in life is self-reliance, this desire to get away from civilization and particularly from the reaches of government, and that still informs our national mythology to this day.
The men of Earth came to Mars. They came because they were afraid or unafraid, because they were happy or unhappy, because they felt like pilgrims or did not feel like pilgrims. There was a reason for each man. They were leaving bad wives or bad jobs or bad towns. They were coming to find something or leave something or get something, to dig up something or bury something or leave something alone. They were coming with small dreams or large dreams or none at all. But a government finger pointed from four-color posters in many towns. There's work for you in the sky. See Mars! And the men shuffled forward, only a few at first, a double score. For most men felt the great illness in them even before the rocket fired into space. And this disease was called the loneliness. Because when you saw your hometown dwindle the size of your fist, then lemon size, then pin size, and vanish in the fire wake, you felt you had never been born. There was no town. You were nowhere, with space all around, nothing familiar, only other strange men. And when the state of Illinois, Iowa, Missouri, or Montana vanished into cloud seas, and doubly when the United States shrank to a misted island, and the entire planet Earth became a muddy baseball tossed away, then you were alone, wandering in the meadows of space, on your way to a place you couldn't imagine.
What I think is interesting about this book is, well, this book adopts a bit of that. Certainly in the earlier chapters, there's a lot of this as you mentioned before, this drive for the stars as a parallel to the drive towards Western expansion. It ends up on a kind of a critique of that too, because the tragedy of this book is the people can't get away from themselves. They can get away from Earth, but they can't get away from being people, and they bring all of the dumb stuff that people bring. There's like that story about the guy who's going to open up the only hot dog stand on Mars, and he thinks he's going to make $1 million, and he is land granted by a bunch of Martians who don't care anymore, half the planet, and he thinks, oh, here's my big break. And then it turns out that war breaks out on Earth. No matter where the people go on Mars, they're still bringing all the bad stuff about civilization along with them, to the point that in the miniseries that you mentioned, they really try to drive this home, because in that sequence at the end where the father is telling the kids, now we're the Martians, they are burning all this, like all these books that represent the ways of doing life on Earth, and they burn both a copy of Das Kapital and of Wealth of Nations. So we're going to burn both communism and capitalism, and I guess what do they have left? I guess they don't have an economy.
I don't know. Try something new. Figure something new out. Write a new book. Think so smart. Publish a new book. Smart guy. Yeah. I think without going too far down this path, I think the idea of the frontier in the American mind is also, like, that's what science fiction, modern and, you know, 20th century too, science fiction is about, is seeking a new frontier, seeking, you can't tell stories about undiscovered things on Earth anymore, because we discovered all the things. So now you have to take your allegories out into space, because you need to have some clear territory in which to tell these stories. And that's, you know, that's why Bradbury, I think, is working in this sort of fantastic genre, is because he wants to get allegorical and he needs to have it be a little bit unreal, and setting it in history and having it be people in the desert Southwest seeing the remnants of a great civilization, or in Mexico seeing a remnant of a great civilization that has faded away, is a little too real. So instead we make it Mars.
Yeah. But it you're right. So much of that golden era of science fiction is about frontier and exploration. This is an interesting book to me because it carries within it a critique of that.
Yeah.
And,
for sure.
And people think of that kind of critique as being the purview of what was called new wave science fiction that came about in the late 60s and 70s, and people like Harlan Ellison, who were like, you know, screw this. This is, I'm not going to tell stories that are uplifting and happy. I'm going to tell stories about how bad people are. But Bradbury was doing it, and he was doing it a lot earlier than a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's in his own lyrical, melancholy way, but it's definitely, at least the way I choose to read it, is he's definitely not saying, isn't it great that the humans are here and they're mowing down the sites of the old Martians and killing the old Martians and giving them germs so they die? Like, that's also like right on the nose. He's not. That's part of the melancholy, right? Is this thing is passing and this new thing comes in, and for the new thing to come in, the old thing has to die, and one of those things is happy and one of those things is sad, and you know, he doesn't, he's, you know, through his eyes, I think lots of things are very sad, right? So that's helpful, because then he's applying a level of sort of melancholy and judgment that goes along with it that you might not get in a more upbeat, positive story of colonizing Mars.
As I was reading this through, it occurred to me the last time I did Fahrenheit 451, I was a little hard on Bradbury. I find him a bit of a frustrating author, because there's this thing that I get from him, which is he was an autodidact. He never was college educated, and he seems to really want to show you his bona fides as an intellectual. In this set of stories, he quotes Lord Byron, he quotes Teasdale, and he's going to make these literary allusions, these classical allusions. I feel sometimes like he's trying really hard.
I agree 100%. Like, and I think he is trying really hard, and at his best, it works. But when it doesn't work, you can see how hard he's like really grinding it. And that's always been my frustration with him, is that there are often moments, and it's nice in this because they're individual short stories. With longer novels, you have to really kind of grapple with it. Like, there are often paragraphs that are beautiful, sentences that are beautiful, chapters that are beautiful. And then you will run into something where you're like, wow, buddy, I we see that you're a writer, but like, and I don't know what it is, but like, he's always struck me that way too, which is he's so ambitious and he really wants to write beautiful flowery prose. And sometimes it hits the spot for me, and other times I think, you're trying too hard. Exactly right. Which is like, you could have backed off this a little bit and it still would have been really good. And now you've kind of forced it too far. And I don't know what that says about what I'm looking for or what it says about him as a writer. It's not like he isn't capable of writing fantastic, beautiful stuff. It's just that sometimes it comes on a little too strong.
It always amused me no end that when Michael Moore did his movie Fahrenheit 9/11, Bradbury screamed bloody murder and said, "You can't do that. You can't use my title. That's a terrible misuse of my title." And I was thinking, this is from the guy who literally wrote a story called a book called Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Uh-huh.
And one of the stories in this is called There Will Come Soft Rains. He's a guy who just
Usher too.
Usher. He just pulled, you know, titles from everywhere, and particularly titles from Shakespeare and the Bible. He was trying really hard, you know, to give these things a bit of weight. You know, maybe he wasn't on board with Moore's politics, but I don't think you can play that game. I think that's the way that's the way culture works, is we quote each other.
Yeah. Yeah, that's I don't get it. He's a weird guy, and like he's definitely an author that there's stuff that's good and there's stuff there where a lot of people look at it and go, no, that's not for me. But I was reluctant, as I often am when I come on this podcast. I'm like, oh, I got to read this again. Is it going to totally ruin it? And I was actually a little bit ambivalent about Bradbury in general and this book in particular. And having gone through it again, basically, there's a bunch of really good stories in here. And I think I do read short story anthologies, or nominees that are on, like, you know, short lists for awards and things. So I do read collections of short stories. And the great thing about short story collections is that if one doesn't hit you, you just move on to the next one. And my goal is not, with a novel, it would be like, does it hang together? How does it work as a whole? And for The Martian Chronicles, like, I don't think it works as a whole. I don't think it is a whole. And there are a bunch of really great bits in it. And I kind of am okay with that. Like, the bar, for me, the bar is much lower because of what it is, and that I can discard the stuff that doesn't work for me.
All right. Well, whatever we think of Ray Bradbury, Rachel Bloom wrote that song about
him. Speaking of Hugo nominees.
and that basically launched her career. So we have Bradbury to thank for Crazy Ex-Girlfriend in a strange way.
Yeah.
And so I'm happy about that.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Good job, Ray Bradbury.
Thanks again to my co-host, Jason Snell. You can hear Jason on most of the podcasts here on the Incomparable Network, including The Incomparable and the ever-fascinating Robot or Not. The reading this time was by David Lohr of the Incomparable Radio Theater. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by the Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. You can write the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. And right now, I would encourage you to do so, because I'm looking for a new round of books, plays, poems, and other assigned readings to do for the podcast. You can also join in on the Facebook page or the Incomparable membership Slack. Whatever we end up doing next, keep up the reading, because everything will be on the final.